Thank you. It's thanks to the organizers for inviting me. I feel it's really a great conference with a great atmosphere. And so what I'm I going to talk about? So the title is slightly long: Towards New Foundation of Quantum Theory from First Principles and from Quantum Field Theory. So new foundations means really that I want to present or advocate a formulation of quantum theory that in some sense is, I think of as more fundamental than the standard formulation of quantum theory. It's not a modification of quantum theory. And it turns out that one can get to this formulation from two completely different directions. And this is why in the title I have first principles on the one hand and quantum field theory on the other. So what's the motivation for that? So let me just mention the original motivation I had when I started this project quite some time ago. So the standard formulation of quantum theory, by which I mean, well, you just talk about quantum systems in terms of Hilbert spaces and algebras of observables that act as operators. So the standard formulation, to make sense, you need a fixed notion of time, or at least of temporal order, a priori, for this to make sense. So otherwise you can't talk about what it means to compose measurements and things like that. Now, of course, if you need that, that precludes the possibility of formulating a quantum theory of gravity where time and, in fact, all of metric space-time should be an element of the dynamics of the theory. It's not something that you can plug in from the beginning. So that's what I see as kind of the fundamental problem of quantum gravity, really. So this motivates the search for a formulation of quantum theory which does not have this dependence, and in fact in the best possible case would be timeless and in some sense more fundamental than the usual formulation. So I claim that such a formulation exists, at least one such formulation, and it's still under development, but I feel that its outline is becoming clear, and that's what I want to talk about to you today here. So, as I mentioned already, it turns out that there are different paths to arrive at this, and in particular, there's a path that's the one that I followed for a long time, which is a conservative path and analytic in a sense. Namely, you start with quantum theory as we know it, and you try to deduce from quantum theory, and in particular from quantum field theory, which is kind of the most fundamental description of nature that we have. You try to deduce from that underlying structure. The other path is a path that's more radical and is constructive. And there what you say is, well, let's forget about quantum theory as we know it concretely and just try to build up from first principles how a description of physics should look like, or how what would be an adequate framework to describe physical theories. So, in fact, I want to start with the second approach because that makes much more clear the operational role of the ingredients of this formulation. And then in the second part of the talk, quickly show you how to get there from the conservative point of view. So if you start from first principles, of course, you cannot start from nothing. I mean, you have to make assumptions. You need ingredients, and you do need empirical guidance to some extent. So I've singled out here two principles that I want to use for that. So one of the principles is locality. So we have learned that to understand and describe local physics, knowledge or control of the immediate spatial and temporal surroundings is sufficient. So basically, we don't have influences at a distance. And that's been a guiding principle for physics for a long time. And it's very has proven to be very effective in our description of the phenomena. So the second point, which is something that in for this audience I have to explain much less than to other audiences, is operationalism, so the way I want to view this here is that, I mean, if we are in classical physics, then the task is kind of a physical theory is to describe how the world is with particles and fields distributed in space-time, and there's one true world, and that's what we have to describe. So in quantum theory, it's quite different because we know that, I mean, making a measurement has is something that cannot be viewed as isolated from the rest of the world, and it has an influence on the world itself. So we have learned that rather than what we should do is rather than describing somehow how the world out there is, and that's the true picture, we should describe how we interact with the world and construct our understanding of the world based on our interaction with the world in the sense of an observer or experimenter. So this obviously is very much inspired by this operationalist wave, in particular by Lucian. So for example, goes back to things like the causaloid framework and things like that. And also, it turns out that this will be related to general probabilistic theories. So it fits well with a lot of the developments we've seen here, especially on Monday. Okay, so let's start with locality. So since we want to be minimalistic, what notion of locality can we posit? It's a very basic notion of locality. Namely, it's a notion where we isolate some region of space-time from the rest of the universe. Okay, so we look at regions of of space-time and say, well, okay, we are interested in the physics inside the region, say, and the rest of the universe is outside, and there's the boundary between the region and the rest of the universe. So this boundary is not something physical, it's something that we put there to be able to make a distinction and to be able to talk about locality. Now, on the boundary, so of course there's the rest of the universe influences the physics here and vice versa. So to encode this influence or this interaction, I want to talk about on the boundary about boundary conditions. Okay, so this again is an expression of this locality that anything that happens outside can be encoded on the boundary itself. Okay, I mean, not encoded in the sense that on some piece of the boundary I have something, but for the moment I just want to think of the boundary as a whole. Okay, so this notion of locality and of space-time region, that's obviously, that's a notion of space-time that I'm introducing here. So I'm talking about four-dimensional space-time regions and their boundaries, which are hypersurfaces. So I do introduce from the very start a notion of space-time, but it's a very weak notion of space-time. So in particular, this is not, there's no metric or anything necessarily. Okay, so mathematically speaking, to be precise, we could talk about topological manifolds. Okay. Now, so far so good, but oh, thank you. So now comes in this the second principle or guideline, the operationalism. So if we want to probe the physics inside this region, well, what we should put is something that I will actually call a probe. But you can think of it as a quite general thing. I mean, you put some kind of apparatus, or you have some kind of process. Sorry. for the moment, I want to be still kind of vague of what this is. But the role this plays is that this should encode the interaction of, let's say, an observer or experimenter with local physics in the region. Yeah?
Just a quick question. You said that there's no metric on this. So why are you justified in calling it a space-time region and talking about local physics?
It's this very, very weak notion of locality, which only consists in distinguishing the interior from the exterior of the region. It doesn't involve distance, for example. So it's a very weak notion of locality. Okay, so that means that with space-time regions, we associate probes that encode precisely this. In particular, there's also a special probe which consists in just doing nothing and not looking and just having the space-time region being there, okay? Like in this picture here. And I just call this the null probe. But it's just the terminology. So something extremely important in physics is that not only can I do experiments or make local observations, but I have a notion of comparison and of composition. In fact, Lucien also was emphasizing in his talk very much that we need a notion of composition. So that means if I have an experiment here, then I can, I mean, for the moment, I want to talk about this again in very elementary terms. So then the two together, viewed together, again, are an experiment, okay? I mean, kind of trivially. But nevertheless, in terms of the objects we have, that means that we have a composition property, okay? That probes in the adjacent space-time region can be composed to a joint probe in a joint space-time region. Well, one thing I also want to emphasize here is that this the notion of locality I'm using can be viewed as some kind of holography in a very basic sense, namely that the information about local physics, that is the physics that is happening inside this region, is communicated through the boundaries, or in particular, if we have adjacent regions, then communication is exclusively through interfacing hypersurfaces. So in this picture, for example, the communication or information interchange, to use the word information because that's happens through the hypersurface, and also, of course, there could be information interchange through this boundary and whatever happens in the surrounding region, but it's always through the hypersurface and moreover encodable on the hypersurface, and this encoding is why I use the word holography here. Okay. So this for the moment doesn't have anything to do with counting degrees of freedom yet. It just has to do with encoding information. Okay, so let's try to be a little bit more precise and say more precisely what are the structures. So we have this notion of space-time, which is very general and just in terms of regions and hypersurfaces. And then we have, for the space-time regions, we have these probes. So let's just put a letter to this. So I call the space of probes PM. And the null probe is a special one. So I use this symbol here for the null probe. And I have a notion of composition of probes when the space-time regions can be glued together. And I'll denote this with this little diamond there. Now, on the hypersurface, as I already mentioned, on hypersurfaces, we have boundary conditions, and I will call B sigma the space of boundary conditions, okay? And yeah, as I said already, these boundary conditions encode possible physical information flows between the two adjacent regions to the hypersurface when it's appearing in a gluing, okay? But it's important to say that the flow or the influence goes, of course, both ways, right? Both directions. Okay, so now, so far, it has been quite general and vague, but in physics, of course, we want to have a quantitative description of things, so we need to talk about numbers. And as tradition is in physics or theoretical physics, I mean, one usually says, well, basically anything that you can measure, you can express it in terms of real numbers. I mean, one real number or various real numbers. So we'll just follow this tradition here and use real numbers. So concretely, that means that, and this also clarifies a bit more what I mean exactly with a probe. So if we have a space-time region, and we have a probe in the space-time region, and we have a certain boundary condition, then we get a real number from that. Okay, and I call them values. Okay, it's a real number. Okay, so that also clarifies a bit more what I mean by the probe. So the probe is not just putting some apparatus, but something more specific that would usually be a question that I'm asking in my experiment, like yes or no for something or a certain value of a pointer position on my apparatus or something like this. Okay, so we have this. Formally speaking, it's a map from the space of probes times the space of boundary conditions on the boundary to the real numbers. Okay. Okay, now it turns out, which is not so obvious from what I've told you so far, and would take too much time if I told you all the details, that with a bit further reasoning and about locality and what it means to do experiments and so on, you get a lot more structure on these spaces. Okay, I will some of these aspects I will make precise later, but in particular, for the probes, it turns out that the probes, okay, so this also has to do with, maybe I should have mentioned that already, that in general, I don't expect that the statements I can make with these values here, that they correspond to making certain predictions about outcomes of measurements, but in general, I only expect that I will be able to do probabilistic predictions, okay? So probabilities come in, and so it turns out that that the space of probes becomes a real vector space. becomes a real vector space with a partial order. So in particular, there's a subset, a cone, of positive elements, and in fact, I call these positive elements primitive probes, and I'll explain this a little bit more on the following transparency. So for the moment, just believe me, and then for the boundary condition, something similar happens. They also become a real vector space, and there's a positive cone of what one could call strict boundary conditions in that. And and moreover, there's a duality between these vector spaces, so which means that if I take a positive element here and pair it with a positive element here, the real number I get will be positive. Okay, again, so I'll explain those things a little bit more soon. So please bear with me. Moreover, it turns out that on the space of boundary conditions, you naturally get an inner product, which is not necessarily positive definite, couldn't have positive and negative definite components, and that's then called a Krein space. Okay. Moreover, there are further structures that are not, in terms of the mathematical structures on these individual objects, but that have to do with composition. Composition of objects. In particular, so all of this together leads you to an axiomatic system. Okay. I mean, having all these structures. So, talking about composition, it turns out that this notion of composition can be made much more precise, and that you get this formula here. So that means for the composition of probes in adjacent spacetime regions. So we saw already that we get an inner product here, and it turns out that if you fix boundary conditions here and here, then the value for the composite probe is exactly a product of values for the individual probes, where here on the hypersurface where they meet, you sum over an orthonormal basis. Okay, so this factor of minus one here just comes about because you can have negative definite components. Okay, but that's not a big deal. Okay, so I mean, rightly you would ask me, well, where does all this come from? And perhaps in the question time. Well, I mean, here, I mean, my idea of these boundary conditions is very general. I mean, I'm not yet talking about specific theories. I'm trying to make inferences about how, in general, we can describe something. So, one thing I should definitely say is that, so what you should really think of as physical boundary conditions are the elements in this positive cone only. And moreover, they are, in general, probabilistic convex combinations. Okay. So, no. I mean, you can do that. You can do classical statistical physics, and in what? So there's nothing quantum here. I mean, I haven't even talked about classical or quantum theory. I mean, just about. I mean, later, of course, I want to go in that direction, but for the moment, and I should really emphasize these structures, I mean, are not postulated, okay? I mean, of course, I need some certain assumptions, but they are very mild, in my opinion, to get to this. If you ask me in the questions, I will can derive this for you, for example. But oh, yeah, you mean like into this and this piece? Yeah, there are some questions. Yeah, so there's some fine print here that... Yeah, it's a very justified question, and later I can say more about this. Okay, so now let me explain a bit where this positive structure or this partial order comes from. I told you that there are these primitive probes. So what are they? Well, they're simply experiments that correspond to setups where I have a definite binary outcome. For simplicity, let's call it yes or no. Okay. So so you should think of an apparatus with a light on it, for example, let's say a light that could be red or green, and at the end of the experiment it will show one or the other, and then you can associate a probe with the apparatus and the situation that in the experiment you find this to turn out green. Okay, there's and you also have so you can set up the value for this given some boundary conditions. So here this thermometer represents boundary conditions. Okay, now but to be able to turn that into a probability, the probability to see green, what you have to do in general, you have to divide by the situation where which looks as where you have the same boundary condition and you also have a probe, but this time the probe is in fact the same apparatus, except that you don't fix the outcome to be green. You just leave it undetermined. Okay. So this would be equal to the probe with green plus the probe with red. Okay. So in general, the outcomes of the predictions for measurements, let's say, are quotients of a type like this. Okay. So in this case, we're asking what's the probability to find it green. I mean, given all the other stuff that we have, the apparatus, that we have this certain boundary condition, and so on, and then I get this. Now, okay, wait. Okay, so now let's consider the probe for green, for red, and the undetermined one, and of course, for any boundary condition that's in this positive space here, you get an inequality, so the relative probability for for red or for green is less than the relative probability for not determining the output state. I mean, this is just the two of them together. Now, since you have this inequality for all boundary conditions in this cone, this induces an order structure on the space itself. Okay, so you can say that this probe is actually less or equal than this probe. I mean, this is less or equal than that, and this is where this order structure comes from on the space of probes. Okay, and similarly for boundary conditions, you also have this order structure, and a physically kind of simple example would be to look at the thermometer and say, well, here I have a boundary condition that tells me I have a temperature between 10 and 20 degrees Celsius, here between 10 and 15, and here between 15 and 20, and then I have automatically this hierarchy. And that reflects itself exactly then in an inequality for the values, given that I take primitive probes. Okay. So that induces the partial order on the space of boundary conditions. And also, because I'll come back later to this example, you can also consider conditional probabilities arising from boundary conditions alone, where in the inside you don't do anything. So you can, it does make sense, it turns out, to ask about how probable is a boundary condition giving another boundary condition, which is more general than this one. And the reason why this makes sense is that you are adding information here. I mean, in the moment that I say this lives on the boundary of a region, I'm adding information, because the boundary condition itself lives on the hypersurface. But what I'm doing here, I'm adding the information that this is the boundary of a region, which of course gives me physical constraints. In that moment, I can ask for this conditional probability. Okay. Okay. So this formalism that I'm arriving at here, an axiomatic system, if you want, together with the rules for extracting. Okay, I only talked about probabilities, but it's straightforward to generalize this to expectation values. The only thing you change is that here, instead of having green, you allow scale. And here again, you don't look at the scale. Okay. So this is what I call the positive formalism. Now, originally I kind of wanted to say something about quantum theory. Where's quantum theory? It's not all at all evident that there's anything with quantum theory. What is more evident is that it's quite straightforward. I will not give you the details, but it's not so difficult to see that you can put classical physics into this formalism when you take probes to be observables. So what happens in that case, which I would like to mention here at this point already, is that the spaces of boundary conditions in that case are lattices. Or more specifically, these arise as spaces of functions on sample spaces, right? And of course, the sample spaces here are actually spaces of local solutions of the equations of motion of the classical system. Okay. So I don't have time to explain this in more detail, but what I want to take away here is that fact, and that imposes a particular additional mathematical structure on these spaces. Okay. Okay. And now for something completely different. Okay, so forget all this stuff. And let's go to quantum theory and see how, starting from quantum theory, we could try to find a formulation of quantum theory that would not depend on a predetermined notion of time. And to do that, what's the first place to look at? Well, the first place, in my opinion, the best place to look for that is quantum field theory. Why? Because quantum field theory is our best description of fundamental physics that we have. So it's naturally to take it very seriously. And in particular, what I want to do, I want to take it seriously from a foundational perspective. Okay, I want to look at it and see if quantum field theory cannot maybe tell us something about the foundations of quantum theory. So usually in a textbook, you will see, well, first people say, what is quantum theory? And then they say, well, having that, the standard formulation of quantum theory, we can set up quantum field theory. But if you look at how quantum field theory is really used and what the structures are that are used to make predictions about nature, then you find structures that are not at all so much in accordance with the ingredients of the standard formulation of quantum theory. So you might wonder, is it more natural not to build quantum field theory on a different foundation? And maybe it can tell us itself what this foundation should be. So in particular, you have things like the Feynman path integral, which turns out to be much more suitable and efficient to describe the dynamics of quantum field theory than a Hamiltonian or time evolution operator point of view. You have other things that I'll not have time to come in. There's something called crossing symmetry, which from the point of view of the standard formulation of quantum theory is not at all motivated. It seems like it's something that has to do with a particular structure that quantum field theory has and the Lorentz symmetry and so on. But can we take this more seriously at a fundamental level? Then also, you don't talk about the product, the ordinary product of operators in quantum field theory. You talk only at the moment where you want to calculate stuff, you only talk about the time-ordered product. So that suggests that this usual operator point of view maybe is not the most adequate one. So to motivate this a bit more, if you look at a transition amplitude between early time and a late time with a unitary evolution, so in quantum field theory you would express that using the path integral. So it's an integral over all field configurations in the space-time region here. And you And here you're integrating over the wave functions over the configuration spaces of fields at the initial and the final hypersurface, and you integrate the wave function, the initial and the final wave function of the initial and final state, with these configurations and with this kernel, which is this path integral. Okay. Now the path integral so now let's think about composition in this case in a temporal sense. So we have initial and later time interval. Then of course the transition amplitude can be split into two pieces, an initial one and a later one, and you just sum over complete bases in between. Now in the path integral, that you can do the same, and this is just the corresponding convolution of the kernels of so which is this path integral. And the point is that the path integral for the whole region here is just the composition of the path integral of the individual ones in a very natural way. Now the point of this is that the path integral in fact satisfies a much more general composition property, namely in space-time. So you can do that in space-time. I mean, it's the same picture like this one, except that I have now allowed myself the liberty to consider general space-time regions, and now you have the field configurations living on the boundary here, and here you're integrating over all field configurations on this hypersurface where you glue them together. So this suggests that quantum field theory itself may incorporate such a generalized composition property. Now, people in the 80s started to take that seriously. In particular, Witten kind of started the physical ideas, and then the mathematicians came in, Siegel and Atiyah and so on, and defined a mathematical framework that's called topological quantum field theory, which incorporates precisely this idea and leads to a setting where you talk about space-time regions, Hilbert spaces on hypersurfaces, and So you have Hilbert spaces on hypersurface, and for regions, you have amplitude maps. So that's a map from the boundary Hilbert space to the complex number, which is a straightforward generalization of the transition amplitude here of that. Okay, except it's now in space-time. And you have axioms that you can then deduce from that. And one of them, a composition rule. Okay, so this picture now looks familiar. It looks almost exactly like the one I showed you before. And it turns out that's not an accident. okay, so far this is only the mathematical framework that you're generalizing. But it turns out that you can add to that a physical interpretation. I mean, usually when you talk about amplitudes, you can, of course, associate amplitudes. You can, if you have a transition amplitude, you can talk about probabilities here. You can talk about probabilities for processes inside, which in this case is just a plain evolution, depending on preparation of initial state and looking for a certain final state. Now, it turns out that you can generalize this. Okay, so this is again that same picture, just to make the link between the old language and the new language. I call these amplitudes now rho. Okay, so these are those things here. And it turns out that in the same way as you can talk about probabilities for transition amplitudes, you can talk about probabilities for these much more general amplitudes. Okay. So to talk about them, you have to talk about, one way to do this is to talk about subspaces of the boundary Hilbert space. So as usual, they're conditional probabilities. So you have one ingredient that represents your preparation, another ingredient that represents the observation or question you're asking. And then it turns out that taking this amplitude square and summing over a complete basis. In fact, here the basis is restricted to this A subspace, and here the basis is restricted to the larger S subspace, you get a probability. And moreover, this reproduces exactly the standard transition probabilities and more. But okay, so the key point here is that in the moment that you do that, you didn't have to talk about time and ordering. And if you combine this with this composition property, this one, you see that you can talk about probabilities and generalized evolution in space-time without ever talking about time, and you can still extract probabilities. Okay, and these probabilities in the special case where you have the standard space-time and so on, and you look at the standard geometries like this geometry, you recover the standard probabilities. Okay, so then you can also integrate observables into that in the same way, also with the path integral and so on. And you can get a notion of composition for observables that looks very similar. And you can also talk then, similar to the amplitudes, you can talk about expectation values of observables in this generalized setting, although there are certain restrictions here because this will not in general be a real number. Only that has to do with the role that observables play in quantum field theory, but okay. So that's a certain defect here of this formulation. Anyway, so this is what I call this program that I showed you now in the second part of the talk started quite some time ago in 2003, in fact, and I call this the general boundary formulation. So that's aimed at a formulation of quantum theory that with precisely the properties I mentioned at the beginning. Now, this specific version I have been showing you so far is what I now call the amplitude formalism because it uses amplitudes. And then it turns out that, of course, if you want to talk about general measurements and processes, you can't do that only talking about elements of Hilbert space. You need mixed states. And it turns out, surprisingly, that this whole formalism generalizes to a mixed state version. So for the Hilbert spaces, that's of course straightforward. So you replace the Hilbert spaces on the hypersurfaces with spaces of bounded operators on them, and then you restrict to self-adjoint operators, and that gives you real vector space. Now, what's more amazing is that the same thing can be done for amplitudes, and you get, I call them probability maps, and these are maps that are positive now if you put in a positive element on the boundary, and you can do something similar for the observables. But moreover, so the point is that the formalism that you get is exactly the same formalism I showed you in the first part of the talk, okay? And moreover, not only are the mathematical ingredients the same, the axioms are the same, also the rules for extracting probabilities and expectation values are the same. Okay. And so in contrast to this amplitude formalism, we can also incorporate more general processes, quantum operations, and so on, and compose them correctly in this positive formalism. Okay, so now... maybe that's the last thing I'll mention in this talk. So I told you before, when I came from this kind of first principles perspective, that you could encode classical physics in that, and in that case, these spaces of boundary conditions were lattices and were basically spaces of functions on sample spaces. So in this case, what happens? They're of course as I said, spaces of self-adjoint operators on the Hilbert spaces. And what are they? Well, one way to characterize, I mean, these are, of course, not lattices. One way to characterize them due to some guy in 1951, Kedison, is as anti-lattices, okay? So here it seems that, in a certain sense, they are as few lattices as is possible, okay? So in this context, that seems to be the distinction between classical and quantum theory in this framework. Although that's still quite unclear to me. I'll end with this kind of overview picture where some of the ingredients are drawn here. Thank you.
When you introduce the expression for the conditional probability of internal quantum mechanics finding some measurement outcome given a preparation, did I understand correctly that you divide the boundary into two parts, one corresponding to sort of all the information that comes into your region?
Okay, so in this example, of course, I do that because that's the standard example. But the point is that here you don't need to do that, and you can come up with examples where this is not happening. Okay, I mean even taking this kind of geometry, you can consider examples where these subspaces relate to vectors that are both in the initial and final part here of this. I mean, both partially here and partially there.
So how do you determine which vector should be in which subspace?
you mean here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean here. So this is very okay. Maybe. Okay. Sorry. No. Okay. So I've had some. Yes, backup slides. This one. So, for example, if you look at the situation where you have an initial state and a final state, and you want to look at this probability, so what does it mean? It means that you prepared psi 1, and you're asking if the final state will be psi 2, right? So, how do we encode this? Well, the preparation. So we are always talking about the boundary as a whole here. So the preparation, okay, so here I haven't written it as a subspace, I've written it as a projector. Is the projector onto the state psi 1 on the initial Hilbert space, and it's the identity on the final Hilbert space. Okay, so that's the subspace, corresponds to the subspace that's spanned by all vectors that take the form psi 1 tensor something. Okay, so this is S. Now, what is A? Well, S is the stuff I already know, so I take it into account when I ask my question. So I add, moreover, now that on the second side, I don't have the identity, but I have a projector to psi 2, to the state psi 2. Okay, so now I plug this in. Okay, so on the left, I wrote the equations for the positive formalism. I'm sorry, in the first part of the talk, I used this notation. In the second part, I used this notation. So this would be how it looks like in the positive formalism. This would be how it looks like in the amplitude formalism. And then you can check that that's just the usual result.
So certainly the work that myself and Julian Clavick has been doing was done in the context of circuits. Although, you know, again, certainly in my papers I discussed the general boundary case, which is a few earlier ones. And then a lot of the structure is very similar between probabilities on frameworks. And you have this sort of thing where you have the general property framework, which is more general than quantum theory, contains classical and quantum theory. Then you have, and it's done in a kind of space-time sort of point of view with respect to arbitrary circuits. And then you have practical quantum theory into the framework in the context of it's the quantum cones approach. In my context, it's the operator tensor approach. And those two approaches are very similar. I think they're very similar to the thing you put at the end with the tensor matrices. The one key difference which maybe is worth asking about is that in our approaches we have this on the boxes, this is input output structure, which means we have some causal structure part of the picture. When you put that on a manifold, it's essentially saying we have at least some of the metric structure, the distinction between past and future. That's crucial when it comes to writing down what the constraints are, saying the context of the quantum case, what the constraints are on the operator. So you have what I call the pavia causality condition, which is the condition of, which is a constraint of causality, translated directly into a condition on these operators. And that's how you get the state space. Without that condition, and demanding also the probabilities are between 0 and 1, without that, then you don't get the right state space. That's what defines the theory. Do you have, it seems like you don't have that condition.
Yeah, okay, so, I've already talked with Giulio, we thought about this already. Anyway, so one thing that's that I don't have, which is related to that, or part of what you're saying is, I mean, usually you have these normalization conditions that, for example, the states have trace one, and that a dynamical map has the property that if you compose it with a trace at the end, it's the same as just taking the trace and things like that, right?
Preserving.
So I don't have them. So for me, these are should be thought of as elements of the dynamics of the theory. Okay, why? Okay, it's still not clear if I can also put certain conditions that are going in the same directions or not. But I'm not sure whether I would need them or not. But one thing I can tell you is context or one aspect of these conditions that I don't need. So in your framework or yours or in the usual way of doing these diagrams. you usually take probabilities to come directly from these maps that I called these things here. So in my case, I always a priori have quotients, and that in some sense fixes the normalization so that. These quotients are always probability. I mean, if these are primitive probes, then the quotient is automatically a probability. There cannot be anything wrong. But of course, if I forget the denominator and just look at this object, this will not be a probability in general. I mean, if I would impose normalizations in that way, then I could make this into a probability.
But I also have these quotients that go by the name of
F. Yeah.
That's a different thing, because that's not really telling you much about the shape of the state space. It's just telling you the causality condition really tells you something about the shape of the space in a very non-trivial way. I'd be surprised if it's captured.
Here definitely there's no causality in the framework. And I would probably tend to say that this should be viewed as part of the model, but.
I have something to say about that. So I also don't think that anything to do with normalization, and at most can be maybe related to the normalization. Of course, is that you choose the measurement effort, and then you don't fix still the outcome of measurement effort. So when you choose the measurement effort, then it's kind of a restriction of your possibility of the maps that you do, and therefore you may allow some loops, but you can still have consistent probabilities because you fix what you want to measure. You can't change what you want to measure. So it has maybe a relation to the causality in the sense that, in that sense, you allow some loops. However, that what we are in our formalism. The closest to what we are doing. We do have normalizations because we want to have well-defined probabilities for all possible choices of the local system. However, this doesn't allow you to draw the circuit still. So that's why I see that that we don't also have a causal structure. And the similarity is such that in our case we have local laboratories, that's your probe. And then we have a processes, and this is that what connects a local laboratories, and this is your actually the hypersurfaces between the regions. In our case, the requirement is only well-defined probabilities, and that's not in already allow you some more effective probabilities. I don't know what it seems to me that in the comp formalism and Russian, you really add an additional constraint in the sense of causality. Like no signaling from
Yeah, I think so too. But it's not clear at this point yet.
Janka. What I asked before is the composition absolutely has a topological complexity. And I'm not sure at all it's for all complexities, all solutions, for all boundaries. Nile surface.
Yeah, okay, so I mean, if you look at really the details, then of course it's more complicated than what I presented. I mean, especially going the second way. So if you want to, I mean, if you want to do quantum field theory in this way, I mean, then you really have to, I mean, you have to construct these structures explicitly. Okay, I mean, let's just... Yeah, for example, here, I mean, you have to you have to construct, I mean, for a given quantum field theory, let's say, you have to say, what are these Hilbert spaces? What are these amplitude maps? And that's quite a non-trivial problem. and when you do that, there are all kinds of things coming in, like Bianca said. So I mean... These theories in general are complicated things. I mean, even if you take a free quantum field theory, I mean, yeah, if you look at time-like hypersurface and so on, you get kind of degeneracy conditions and so on. So that's in general, that's a problem that's not solved yet. It's solved in certain cases and interesting classes of theories, but not in general. And there are some more profound things to say about that, but I think... let me just mention one thing. So for example, it turns out that I mentioned in my first part of the talk something about Krein spaces. So that was also kind of already informed by the second part, because it turns out that when you do fermions, when you do bosons, it seems that you can get away mostly with just having Hilbert spaces here. But if you're fermions, then you definitely need Krein spaces here at the level of those state spaces here. Just as one comment on that. So.
Okay, it's not really a question, it's like a couple of comments related to what you were saying before. First, on the causality normalization issue that Lucien and Kaslav raised. But I don't have a precise opinion on this yet, but I would like to stress that one thing there is, it's true that in the comp formalism, we fix at some point the causality condition. So we fix this normalization constant. But somehow the original idea that led to this doesn't require you to fix the condition, because the original idea is the idea of supermaps, of idea of mapping higher order objects. We know that quantum channels are the most general maps from state to state, and then we can iterate this question, ask what is the most general map from channel to channel, and we can build up an infinite hierarchy of maps in this way, and then they would have some constraints, some of which are the causal constraints, the other are not. So there is a much richer structure in this notion of supermap than it is with the notion of comps and circuits and tracks. So this somehow reminds me something of the panel discussion yesterday when Professor Kluck was talking about the book we want to have to read the book from the input to the output. So we can extend this paradigm not only to time, but also to this notion of higher order maps. So in this sense, I would say that the most complete theory of this thing would be this collection of books that tell you input-output stories about things that you can do in space-time. And I think that's a pretty promising thing to do. The second comment is a kind of broad comment, something that I find positive and amazing of seeing in your book comparing with what in the general theory framework that people are doing. And this is the fact that somehow, so you came from topological field theory, which is an established part of abstracting from that, you got this formal language of regions and of composing things and of positive operators. So in my case, and in the case of many other people, we came from quantum information, so we are used to quantum circuits. And abstracting from that, we get exactly a framework that is very much related and in some aspect is the same as this. I think this is saying a lot about the attitude of this foundational work that we have today. So these are not arbitrary words of people who are waking up in the morning and saying, here is a set of actions, and we get to tell nature what to do. We are actually kind of seeing and kind of recognizing common structures that are hardcore facts about quantum theory. And I find it really amazing that there is this sort of objectivity of common structures that come from quantum field theory and from the circuit model. I think this is actually a very good argument for the information theory. I think this is more or less the same argument that I heard yesterday about string theory. We are discovering things from the black hole paradox, discovering things from morality. It is amazing that these things are so well related to each other. I think we should say the same about this. It's
I agree.
Evidence that there is something to this thing, to this structure that we are discovering. That's what's just the comment.
Okay, so maybe that's a coffee break of 15 minutes. And that's kind of